back, everyone, to the second part of Authors on the Air. I'm Pam Stack, your host. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. My guest in the second hour is Richard Helms, or Rick, as he's known by his friends. Rick and I have been social media friends for a lot of years. It's really bizarre that I've never invited him on this show before. Bad Pam. But let me tell you a little bit about him first. He's a lifelong North Carolinian, which endears me to him anyway, since I'm from Miami and half of the city is also up in North Carolina. He is retired from the active practice of forensic psychology and has written, I think, like, 19 books or something. It's a really large amount. He is a court-recognized expert in sex crimes and the psychology of sex offenders. Mystery writing was an easy transition, it seems. So I'm really happy, very happy to welcome Rick Helms to the show. Hi, Rick. Welcome to Authors on the Air. I'm sorry it's taken me so long to get you here.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm thrilled that you're here because you just got great publishing news, didn't you?
I did. I just signed a contract with Clay Stafford Books out of Nashville, Tennessee. My previous book publisher was Five Star Cengage, and wonderful people to work with, terrific. But they made a company-wide decision to do away with their mystery thriller line about 2 years ago and sent me the email telling me about it on my birthday. Happy birthday to me. But,
oh, my gosh. You're not kidding. And, you know, my heart fluttered for just a minute there. What do you mean they're getting rid of mysteries and thrillers and suspense? It's unheard of.
Yeah, they closed down the entire line, and I've been looking for a book publisher for the last couple of years. Clay approached me probably about 8 months ago and asked me if I would be interested in participating in a new publishing company he's putting together out of Nashville, Tennessee, that was part of his American Blackguard filmmaking and TV and publishing company that he already had there. So he approached me and asked me if I want to be a part of it, and we just signed a contract about 3 weeks ago, and the first book with Clay Stafford Books will be coming out, I think, sometime this summer, probably in July.
And you have a working title, don't you?
Yes, it's Paid in Spades. It's the fifth book in my Pat Gallagher series, which has been going on. It's been around. It was the first book that I actually had published back about 1999, 2000. The Pat Gallagher series has been very successful. It's been the backbone of my, if you want to use the term, brand. He's a slacker dive or cornet player at a dive bar in New Orleans who somehow just keeps getting himself into trouble. The series has four books out already. Two of them were nominated for the Seamus Award. The short stories were nominated for the Derringer, the McCavity, and the Thriller Award, and won the Thriller Award in 2011. So it's a series that's pretty dear to my heart. And the fifth book, AIDS, is coming out, like I say, sometime this summer from Clay Stafford Books.
So you've been on kind of a hiatus, probably not self-imposed, but through no fault of your own, and not knowing exactly what's going to happen and who's going to pick up your books. How must that make a writer feel? I'm so curious because I imagine sometimes you say, oh, I don't have to rush for deadline, but then, all right, when the hell's the deadline? I need a deadline, right? So
well,
what's going
I've been
on?
Fortunate.
Tell me about it.
I've been very fortunate during this non-self-imposed hiatus, just by chance. I've been able to put out a lot of short stories. And I've been a regular in Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine, a number of stories published there. And so that's kept me pretty busy. In the meantime, I've been writing books that I wanted to write. Since I retired from, you mentioned the forensic psychology bit. For the last 10 years that I worked, I was a college professor here in Charlotte teaching psychology. And I retired from that in August of 2016, so about a year and a half ago. And since then, I've written three novels and a number of short stories. And so kind of building up the inventory, as it were, for when we finally find a place to that'll carry my books again. So. Yeah, it looks like we're just about there.
I want to talk to you, though, because it's so timely. to talk about sex offenders and the psychology of criminals and so on.
Yes.
I feel like you're ahead of your time, Rick. Do you feel like that too? I mean, you are ahead of your time with everything that's happened in this past year with all the sexual assaults and so on. I mean, you'd have to really be blind, crippling crazy not to understand what was going on. Can you kind of give what's your take on what's happening? Because most of us know this isn't new. This is not a new thing. What's your take on why? Why does this happen?
Part of it has to do with the idea of the underlying psychology of the individuals that we're talking about. You know, that we're talking about people like Weinstein and all the others who've been accused.
Right.
I think part of it has to do with the underlying psychology of those individuals and something that Murray McClelland, don't want to get too technical here, but as far back as the 1930s to the 1950s, Murray and McClelland were working on personality studies that looked at things like need for achievement, need for power, need for affiliation. And the need for power part specifically tends to play into this whole area of the sexual harassment and the sexual exploitation of individuals who don't have a great deal of power by people who do have it. And I think what you're looking at is much a symptom of their underlying personality that permeates all the things they do, not just their sexual relationships with other people. They are they're basically being themselves when they're engaging this exploitative and harassing behavior.
It's interesting you say that because I'm sorry. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Well,
continue.
I was just going to say that there's a feature in statistical analysis called Berg's deviation hypothesis, which you can also apply it to the behavior of individuals, which is to say that of course Berg's deviation hypothesis has more letters in it than the actual hypothesis, which basically says that deviant people deviate. So if you find an individual who is acting in a deviant way in one part of their lives, you're probably going to discover, if you dig down deep enough, that they're acting in a deviant way in most areas of their lives, whether it's lying or cheating or stealing or whatever.
That's so profound, though. I mean, for you to say that, it's something that I don't think a lot of us have thought about. They think it's only this one thing. But, you know, I totally hear what you're saying, because I'm a domestic violence survivor. I mean, everybody knows this is not a secret. I'm not letting a cat out of the bag here. And I became a certified victim advocate because I was very lucky to be getting help. And power, control, and entitlement, same thing, all the same symptoms. So it's the lizard part of the brain, I suppose. If you're broken, you're broken. You're broken all over, right?
Very much the case, and I used to work with individuals who would walk in, and these would be individuals who engaged in some pretty nasty behaviors, either with relatives or with people they hadn't even met, and they would sit down, and the first thing they would say very often was, "I can't believe I got caught the very first time I did this." And my response was always a very respectful, bullshit. What I would tell them is, here's the fact: we're gonna dig down into your history, and you just lied to me the first time. You get three, okay, before we take a trot down the hall and talk to your probation officer about why you're not cooperating. But you just lied to me the first time, because if you're here, it's because you've been doing this for quite a while. Okay, and if it's not this, then you've been doing something else that's deviant. And our job is going to be to find a way for you not to be to act deviantly in all of your activities with other people in real life. So we're not just going to be talking about sex offending. We're going to be talking about the whole thing.
All criminality, right? So I want to ask you one more question, then we're going to talk about how this pertains to your books. So my question to you is, we hear a lot about, there's so much mental illness out there, and if there's a mass shooting or something like that, people say it must be somebody who's mentally ill. And I maintain, and it's just me maintaining, that there's a big difference between mental illness and a personality disorder. Am I right or am I wrong?
Well, the personality disorders are one component of mental illnesses, but there are other things that could be going on also. Feelings of powerlessness, lack of hope, feelings of helplessness, feelings of social alienation and isolation. The FBI, the Behavioral Science Unit of the FBI, I think it's now the Investigative Support Unit, developed something they called the McDonald Triad some years ago, that you can take a look at the early development of individuals, and you can pretty much tell if they're going to have problems or not based on the presence or absence of a number of factors. The big three in the McDonald Triad are, bedwetting after the age of 10, fire setting as a child, and childhood cruelty to animals. So we're looking at situations where individuals may, in fact, be, it's one of those as the twig is bent, so grows the tree kind of situations. The roots of their deviance were planted years and years and years before they actually acted out. Now, these individuals may have low self-esteem, they may have low self-concept, they may feel that other people reject them, they feel powerless and hopeless and helpless, and for those individuals, anything that's going to give them a sense of power or a sense of affiliation with other people is probably going to be an attractive alternative for them. When they do finally act out in a way that they hope is going to empower them rather than disempower them, it's a very deviant and shocking act. But for them, it makes sense because they don't see any other alternatives.
Interesting. You have all of this knowledge about the behavior of criminals, but particularly in sex crimes and personal crimes like that. Even though the way you described your character is not one of a deviant, he's just one who can't get out of his own way. How does your knowledge and your profession and your education help you or hurt you when you're writing?
More than anything else, I think it helps me to be able to develop a backstory and a sense of who my characters are, not just from the point that the book starts, but how they got to the point that they are when the book begins, whether they are whether they're the protagonist or antagonist. I really try very strongly to write relatable antagonists, individuals who are working in a way that preserves their own self-interest, even if that's at the expense of other people. I want them to have a logical reason other than just being evil for doing the things that they do.
Are there people who are just evil for the sake of being evil? They're inherently evil?
There are individuals who are, I like to say, they're born without parts that you can't get spares for. Individuals who are genuine psychopaths, for instance, who are born. There's research that's been done using functional magnetic resonance imagery, taking a look inside the brain of individuals who have really profound behavioral disorders. And for those who tend to be acting out in a way that we think of as being psychopathic, one of the things that we find is that a part of the brain, in the very deepest, oldest part of the brain, what we call the limbic system, called the amygdala, which is our source of our fight or flight and emotional responses, is smaller and less developed and lower functioning than it is in so-called normals. And what that implies is these individuals don't get the signals from their own lives, from their surroundings, that should caution them that you're doing something wrong. So, for instance, if I lie or I cheat or I steal, my conscience is probably going to bother me about that. For these individuals, and what we call conscience is what we call the activation of our fight or flight sympathetic nervous system response, whatever we want to call it, that causes us to feel anxious and uncomfortable. For the individuals who don't have those parts in their brain to trigger that response, they're not going to get these internal cues that say what I'm doing is wrong. So what drives their behavior is the end goal. It's going to get me what I want. rather than it's going to hurt somebody else. It's going to get me what I want. And if somebody else gets hurt by that, well, that's their trip. I don't have to worry about that because that's not part of my problem. Yeah, I don't feel bad about it, so they shouldn't either. So they actually see the world in a completely different way than we do. Well, writing
you
a
have...
character like that.
Yes.
You begin to understand why they're criminals or why they're behaving in a deviant way, and suddenly, it's almost, well, if they're born that way, if they're born without these parts, then what do you do with them? I mean, it's not like you can reform them. It's not like you can cure
right.
them.
Right.
So how do you implement an external set of controls?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
So
we see a lot of that in politics. What's that?
Well, yeah, we do. So does one control someone like that? Because I've always maintained, and I've studied a lot about the amygdala, because it is also where the victim's response to threats and things like that. You talk about flight or flight. There's freeze too,
yes,
as you well know.
Yes.
So,
it's a source of all of our PTSD, our post-traumatic,
yes.
that and hippocampus, and right. But it's all about the post-traumatic stress disorder is all about overactivation of that fight or flight response as a result.
Work with clients who've been victimized. I don't know, is there any type of treatment for someone who has a smaller amygdala? Is there something you do with someone who's a sociopath or something? I mean, because to me, that may be brain illness, but it's not mental illness the way you can treat bipolar or depression or something else. It's a different kind of an illness, isn't it?
Exactly. I mean, if you're talking about somebody, for instance, who has Parkinson's disease, they have Parkinson's because a part of the brain that produces dopamine, the dopaminergic clusters of cells in the brain are not creating enough dopamine. Well, you don't say to somebody like that, snap out of it or change what you're doing so you'll be able to avoid these symptoms. You try to impose some kind of external control on it through the use of medication or some other kinds of therapies. People who are psychopathic or sociopathic, Stanton Samanow, who was one of my early trainers when I was first being taught how to do this whole forensic psych thing, what he mm-hmm. basically said was you have to impose external controls rather than trying to build in the internal controls. Because these individuals are missing parts, they're going to need humanity support, as it were, like life support. They're mm-hmm. going to need some kind of external support that's going to remind them and cue them when they're acting in a way that's exploitative or harassing or otherwise harmful to other people. In the absence of those external controls, they're probably not. They're just going to behave according to type.
Yeah, that's a scary thing, isn't it? It really
is.
Yes. Your bad guys are bad. Your main character is, he's not going to get the Citizen of the Year award, but he's a normal guy, and he kind of gets himself into these circumstances. So. And I like the nature of your writing, Rick. I wonder, will you ever think about going really dark with all the things you know?
I try not to because it keeps me awake at night. I wrote a book. The book that I wrote that almost nobody has read. I've sold all of 20 copies. It was written about 20 years ago. It's called Bobby J. And it was based largely on my own experiences as the clinical director in a 24-bed facility for the most violent and aggressive teenagers in the state here in North Carolina. The nature of that population, of course, is when you're dealing with teenagers, you're dealing with individuals who are driven entirely almost entirely by emotional factors rather than
right.
intellectual or rational factors. And therefore, the behavior that a psychopathic or a criminal teenager engages in is going to be much more violent and much less constrained by conscience than an adult might do. That book basically revolves around the abduction and brutal sexual assault on a 5-year-old child by a 14-year-old teenager. And the question there is, what do you do with that individual? The person's a juvenile. You can't send them to prison. You can't, you know, what do you do with an individual who engages in a behavior that is that atrocious?
Yes.
And at the same time, recognize that this is a child, that the perpetrator is also a child as opposed to the victim, who's certainly traumatized
sure.
horribly. But you're dealing with an individual who also is probably a victim at some level also, and you want to try and work with that at the same time you try and change their behavior toward others. That's a very, very, very dark book. A good friend of mine called it the most relentlessly depressing novel he's ever read.
Oh, my gosh, I'm sorry, right?
yeah, I'm sorry. I'll write a happy one next time. That book has never really sold very well because most people can't. It's so dark that people can't even get past the first chapter. I've had a lot of people who read it said, "Well, I read the first chapter and now I just feel like, oh, this thing is 500 pages long. How am I ever going to get beyond that?" And I always tell them, you know, the rest of the book is much easier. The first chapter is
once
written in the way it is to
sure.
for a purpose. But I'm a little wary about going, you know, truly, totally dark, because
right.
I'd kind of like readers. That would be fun to have people actually read the books.
Yeah.
So.
Well, this is true. You're not writing them to give them away, right?
Exactly.
Tell us a little bit about Paid in Spades, the book that'll be released over the summer. Can you kind of give us a little bit of a sneak peek at what to expect?
Sure. Pat Gallagher, for those who are not familiar with the Gallagher series, he is a former, he's a failed seminarian, a retired forensic psychologist, and a disgraced college professor who basically has been on a downward spiral in his life for years. He now lives in New Orleans above a bar where he plays a jazz cornet at night. And because of a gambling addiction, he was forced in the first book, Joker Poker, which came out, I think, 2000. But he was forced to become a collector for a loan shark in New Orleans. So the first 4 books, story arc, in which he meets the love of his life and he goes through several adventures that are kind of tied together, most of them involving working with the mob, though in the
mm-hmm.
most recent one. Oh, I'm sorry. In the third one, he's recruited by a local police detective because of his forensic psychology history to help out with a series of serial killings that are going on in the French Quarter in New Orleans. Well, this fifth book takes up, even though it was written almost 13 years after the fourth book, Wet Debt, it takes place only about 2 weeks later. And he and his girlfriend, Merle Comino, had just returned from San Francisco, where he fled after a big shootout involving the police and some gangsters behind the bar where he works, and picks up almost immediately 2 weeks later with 2 missing persons cases that he's asked to work on. One, his girlfriend, who runs a runaway shelter. There's a young girl there whose father is missing, and she needs an operation on her knee, and they're trying to avoid having her get involved with Department of Social Services and get into the whole child welfare system. So he goes looking for her father. And the other one, though, is a fellow who actually got him into a gambling addiction program, and to whom Gallagher owes just about everything in terms of his recovery, who has also gone missing after asking Gallagher about 6 months earlier to come looking for him should he ever disappear. Well, now he's disappeared, and Gallagher has to look for him. And over the course of the book, the two cases begin to merge, and he begins to realize that they're actually connected with one another. So,
wow. a story Bible so that you know who, you know, who you've written as ancillary characters, never mind your mains, but and that, you know, you make sure their eye color is the same and, you know,
yes,
clothing
yes.
is the same, you know, things like that. How do you keep up? You've been writing for so long. You have so many books. So how do you keep up with it?
I am blessed with a really incredible memory. That helps. I don't have story Bibles as such, but when I am concerned about it, I do. Of course, I have all the books sitting on my computer, and I can search them very quickly. I'm very much a pantser, and I don't use a huge number of recurring characters in my books. The Judd Wheeler series, for instance, is set in a mythical Prosperity, North Carolina, only has like five recurring characters in it. And I can I generally, one of the things I do is I develop I got something, some kind of noise coming over the phone here. But I lost my train of thought when I had that voice in my ear. The character Bibles. What I do is I assign actors to the roles in my head. So that,
really?
For instance, right now, Judd Wheeler is Kyle Chandler. Right now, Pat Gallagher in my head is David Harbour, who plays the police chief on Stranger Things. And so I have these actors in my head that I can, you know, that I know their faces and I know the color of their eyes and I know how their, you know, their lips look and what their hair looks like and all that. And so I can draw on that when I'm writing them. Now there are some characters. There's one who is a works in the genealogy department at the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in New Orleans, who I wrote in the first Pat Gallagher book and has not been seen. He's not been seen since until the fifth book. I had to kind of go back and reread that so I could remember what he looked like. But for the most part, having those character images in my head is very useful for me in order to maintain some kind of continuity from book to book.
Well, you know, you and I were talking about in the green room. We were talking about Robert Crace, and I don't know if you heard him say that he has no idea what his characters' faces look like.
I did read that. I have a very clear idea what they look like, but when reading the books, in fact, I've assigned actors to them. I agree. I think that's fascinating to me. That he doesn't have that image in his head and still maintains the continuity in the books. The main thing we know about Joe Pike is that he's got those arrow tattoos on his biceps, and that's it. You know,
exactly.
There's very anywhere.
We know a little bit from like the third book or something where, you know, he told a lot of his backstory. Anything. By the way, the next book is going to be a Joe Pike book, more Joe Pike than Elvis.
Good.
So that's just a heads up there. But, yes, it's interesting, isn't it? And yet there are other people, when I speak to Jeffrey Deaver, he says, oh, I can tell you exactly who Lincoln Rhimes is. It's a young Harrison Ford. And I'm always stunned, you know, by who the author envisions versus who I envision. But
yes. But
Crace said that he doesn't do it because he wants his readers to form their own opinions and because they'll kind of wrap themselves around the characters they like the best and like the character they've created for the story. So in that regard, it makes sense to me. He also mentioned, and I don't know how you feel about this, that he will never option any Elvis, Cole, and Joe Pike book, ever.
I was just about to mention that in addition to him not having the image, that he has said many times that there'll never be a Joe Pike and Elvis Cole TV show or movie or anything like that. And I think that's fascinating because his background is TV writing. I mean, he came up through the visual media and that he would not want to option that. It's just pretty amazing. Me, I'll sell out in a minute. Just come on to the contract. And
because you're not, but you know, here's the thing. I got it when he talks about that. And so, you know, I understand because he's not finished and he doesn't want, you know, and maybe I'm prejudiced, but You know, Lee Child is a wonderful man. I like Reacher, but I think the character who played Reacher in the movies was a horrible fit. And so maybe there's that fear for some writers that it doesn't translate well, especially if you're going to continue to write the character. That's the only thing I can think of, but it's very personal to him. Now, he sold other books, obviously, but you would sell in a heartbeat, wouldn't you?
Oh, man, can you bring the contract, man. I've got the actors in mind already. I can tell you who to hire. If you can't get them, I got backups.
And even if they don't care, you're going to sign the contract anyway, right?
Sure. Let's get this stuff
so
on the screen. I like traveling, and it's expensive. So bring the media contracts.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Go ahead.
I was going to say I'm a member of a group that's devoted to Travis McGee, and one of the big conversations on that group is who would play Travis McGee. And right now the inside money goes to Matthew McConaughey. But for me, in reading the books, he was always Jeff Chandler. Even though Jeff Chandler died before the first Travis McGee book was ever written, to me, in my head, when I read it, I see Jeff Chandler.
Well, you remember that Sam Elliott played Travis McGee in one movie.
He did, as did Rod Taylor. Rod Taylor did The Dreadful Lemon Sky. I have copies of both movies on VHS somewhere around here. So.
Yeah. VHS, yeah. Wow.
They are talking about doing a Travis McGee series with Matthew McConaughey, so that would be interesting.
He's too old for it. And I'm not a fan. I have to tell you, I'm not a fan, but that's just me. I don't own the television anyway. What do I know? I don't know who any of the new people are. I had to look up the picture for the police chief for Stranger Things when you said that. I had to pull up Google to find out who it is. I don't want to steal all your time, but I did kind of want to talk about a couple other things. And usually at the end of this show, I do something called Final Five. It's five quick questions and five quick answers. So you already kind of said something that's of interest to me. You said you like to travel. What is your favorite place to travel to?
So far, it's been Paris. Paris was just amazing. I can't wait to get back. We've done Italy, Greece, Croatia. We've done Corfu, which is actually in Greece. We've done Monaco, Paris, and of course we're getting ready in the not too distant future to do a drive all the way across country just to see the entire United States from ground level. You know, I've flown over it a bunch of times,
fun.
But I can't wait to see it from the ground level. My wife and I both are avid travelers, and we love cruising. We love going to Europe. We're looking at going to doing some South America stuff. We're looking at travel's a big deal for me. I love it.
I love it. Yeah, don't you? Now, do you want to walk in your character's footsteps around the country?
That would be cool. And of course, the Judd Wheeler series actually took place in the town. It's a fictional a town called Prosperity, North Carolina, but really it was the town I lived in for 23 years. So I'm pretty much familiar with that one. And we've done New Orleans a few times where I do the Pat Gallagher series. We've done San Francisco a couple of times where my Eamon Gold series is set. But lately I've been really focusing on doing a lot of North Carolina based series, mostly because I'm most familiar with this area.
It's a beautiful state.
Oh, yeah.
Beautiful state.
Got everything.
Anyway.
Got the beach, the mountains. It's got everything. So.
You just have snow in the winter, so
a little bit.
Yeah, I know you do. I have a lot of friends up there. let me ask you something. Whose book is on your nightstand right now? Who are you reading?
Right now, I am reading. Who am I reading? I just totally blanked on it. I just finished one of Bill Kreider's books not too long ago. It was his first Dan Rhodes book, and I really enjoyed that. Right now, I'm suddenly totally blanking on what I'm reading. Oh, I'm reading the new Dennis Lehane. The third Joe Coughlin book, after Live by Night.
I love Dennis Lehane. Interesting. James Lee Burke said he thinks he's the best writer ever. He's the perfect writer. Mystic River, he said, was the best movie he's ever seen. He raves about him.
It's a wonderful book, and I've enjoyed all of the Haynes books except for Shutter Island, which I did not enjoy. But I've loved everything else that he's written, and the Copland series that begins with the book. Again, the titles are escaping, but the one around the 1919 police mm-hmm. strike in Boston is the first book, and then Live by Night is the second one.
I love that book.
Made into a movie.
I love that book.
And then I'm reading the third one right now, and I'm only about a fifth of the way through it, and it's really just wonderful writing. I think there's a quote in there where he talks about people in pews that are packed like a roll of nickels. And I just thought, that is so wonderfully descriptive. I just read that earlier.
It is descriptive. You're absolutely right.
I read stuff like that and think, I'll never write that well. So it gives me something to aim for.
There you go. And that's as it should be, right? I always think I've read the best book until I read the next best book. So I guess it's kind of that way with writers, too. So because I have a lot of favorite books. And speaking of, is there any book that you enjoy reading more than once, that you have just said, every year or so I've got to go back and read that book because it's so good?
The great American novel, The Grapes of Wrath.
Really?
To me, nobody will ever write a novel, an American novel, that captures a period in American history as well as Steinbeck did with The Grapes of Wrath. I keep going back to that over and over and over again because it's just such a marvelous story. It's right up there on my greatest novels ever written list.
Oh, good. I'm so glad to hear that. That's nice. It's nice that you like to reread a book, too. I as well. What is something we would be surprised to learn about you?
I'm a woodworker. I build furniture.
Fabulous.
And musical instruments, and I'm looking down. I'm actually in the balcony of my house right now, looking down on the den. My office is up in the balcony, and I'm looking down, and I see two major pieces of furniture that I built: library table and a Morris chair, and there's stuff up here in the office too that I've built, and I built musical instruments, I've built arts and crafts furniture, shaker furniture, things like that. I really enjoy
God.
It.
You are a Renaissance man there, Rick Helms. My last question
I think that's the title of my website.
Oh, there you go, Renaissance man. Okay. Wasn't that Danny DeVito too in the movie or something? So funny.
Yes.
We got to be careful what we say, right? My last question to you is more on a writerly scale. When you look back at your first bit of writing and you look now where you are, what do you say to your beginning self?
Use fewer words.
Economy of words, I'm sure.
I really overwrote the early works because I wanted to impress everybody with my vocabulary, I suppose. But I overwrote everything. And then I started reading again, and I noticed that the writers that I admired the most, with the possible exception of Steinbeck, but there's a lot of economy there, a lot more than, of course, in Faulkner. But the writers whom I admired the most, people like Hemingway and Bob Parker and Crays, a number of others, not necessarily James Lee Burke, because nobody writes like
him.
But most of them liked spare, bare bones, unembellished writing. And what I read somewhere, it was a quote by Miles Davis that said the key to playing good jazz is learning to play the silences, is playing the silences between the notes. And so one of the things that I learned is by reading my own writing and going back and looking at it, it was, use fewer words, try to find a way to connote the feeling and the emotion that you want to using the fewest possible words. I think Elmore Leonard kind of advocated the same thing. If it looks like writing, delete it. and stick with the bare bones of the story, which I think is just a great advice.
Well, I agree with you, and I think it's terrific, and it's not, you're not the first smart writer that I've heard say that. Rick Helm, tell us where we can find you, please, on the internet.
My writing website is www.richardhelms.net. And my personal website, which is a constant work in progress. So there's a lot of empty spaces on it, but there's a lot of neat stuff there too. It features a lot of my woodworking stuff and some my race driving stuff that I did for about 28 years and stuff like that is all over
race
at
driving?
Dub, dub,
race
dub.
Driving? Wait a minute, race
yeah,
driving?
Yeah, I drove race cars for 28 years.
What kind of
I
race
drove
cars?
Everything. I started out in hobby stocks at a little 3/8 mile dirt track in South Carolina. This is when I was 16 years old. It was 1971. And over the years, I drove late model stock cars. I drove TQ midgets. I drove formula cars, enduro cars. If it had wheels, I probably drove it at one point or another. I drove on dirt and asphalt, road courses,
ovals. This
is a whole
other show now. If I had more time in the studio, I'd extend it. First love of mine besides book was fast cars, and to this day I still like them. I actually raced a quarter mile drags racer myself. So, oh my God, and motocross. We're gonna have to talk more about this. You have to come back. You must come back, and here I'll even sweeten the pot a little bit. You must come back and sit behind the microphone, please, and interview someone of your that you like. How about that?
Oh my gosh. I don't know if I can do that. I'm
sure
much better
can.
Answering questions than asking them. But
give
it a try.
You're
sure,
a teacher. You're the professor. You can do this. We absolutely must do this. Rick Helms, thank you so much for being on Authors on the Air. What a delightful conversation this has been for me. Thank you. Promise you'll come back.
I will. Thank you for having me. It's been a great pleasure.
It's been a lot of fun. Thank you so much. Have a good evening. Okay. Good night.
Thank you. Take care.
And that's our show for tonight, folks. Thank you for being with me and for Rick Helms. If you want to find out more, you can go to my website, which is authorsontheair.com, my Facebook page, or Authors on the Air on Facebook. You can find us everywhere in social media. Thanks for being with me. I'll talk to you next week. And thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night, everyone.